We are just about set to go with our next presentation. Dennis Bray is an active professor emeritus at Cambridge University. He has a recent book out called Wetware, A Computer in Every Cell, which describes the computational processes inside cells. He's going to talk to us today a little bit about how we're looking to robotics when we should actually be looking to the computing powers of biology to solve our problems. Please join me in welcoming Dennis Bray.
Thank you. Is this on now? Yeah. Okay. So this is my first AI conference, and it's been a really illuminating experience. And old as I am, I feel carried along by the enthusiasm of the audience, and it's just amazing that you're still here at the end of the day. Thank you. Is the projector on? So it's amazing to me just what has been achieved with intelligent machines, and even more what is possible in the future. But as a card-carrying cell biologist, I feel it's my my loyalty is to the carbon-based systems. And I have to point out that, amazingly, although the future is incredibly attractive, that artificial machines still can't do everything. So robots are very efficient at performing well-defined tasks. But in a real-world situation, they're far less effective. So, for example, even something as simple as reaching out to a bottle of milk and pouring it into a cup is a real challenge for a robot. And things like asking a robot to play a good game of tennis or to cook a meal from scratch. And in particular, things such as read a newspaper and understand what it says are beyond the reach of present-day robots. And this is a puzzle, really, because for the last 50 years, people have been predicting that our world would be populated by sentient robots that would be essentially interacting with humans almost as equals. So the question is, what's gone wrong? Why aren't we much further along in the development than we are? So I'd like to suggest that there are two reasons. One is that we actually don't understand how the humans perform these tasks. And perhaps that's something we could defer to afterwards to the debate with Terry. But the second thing that I'd like to talk about just in the next 15 minutes is that it seems to me that the hardware that's employed in constructing intelligent machines, robots, is not up to the task that it's been set. Let me explain what I mean. So living cells are... I lost my pointer. Can I have my pointer there, please? Thank you. Living cells are very small chambers, membrane-enclosed chambers, containing a highly complicated bag of chemicals. So this is a bacterium, E. coli. It's about 2 microns long, and it's got a lipid membrane, and within the lipid membrane there's a very complicated mixture of chemicals, including DNA, the green. But a large part of the contents are proteins. Proteins make the flagella by which the bacterium swims. They form the receptors that are inserted in the membrane by which it senses its environment. And everything in between, involving the swimming, the sensing, and also the metabolism and the division, proteins play a major part. And just to give you some parameters, E. coli contains about 10 to the 9 protein molecules. And these are made from a set of just over 4,300 genes. The number is known rather precisely, although, strangely enough, not all the functions of the proteins are completely understood. By contrast, the cells in your body, each one is about 1,000 times larger in volume and in content, so they have about 10 to the 12th protein molecules. The number of genes is much larger, but perhaps not as large as you might expect. Certainly, it was a surprise to find when the Human Genome Project was finished that it's of the order of 25,000. And something I hope to return to later, in fact, less than 2% of the human genome actually encodes the protein. So a large proportion of the DNA is doing something else. Proteins, as I'm sure you know, are made in the cell as a linear chain of amino acids, which the sequence of which has been selected by evolution so that they fold up into a precise shape. And this molecule has a surface lattice of atoms which have been selected by evolution so that they have binding sites to which particular other molecules bind and selectively recognized by the protein. So this simple enzyme, hexokinase, has a binding site on its surface for glucose and ATP. It binds these two in close proximity and in such a configuration that a reaction between the two is promoted. Everything happens very fast at the molecular level. So in the cell, hexokinase is diffusing around, encountering glucose and ATP, and spitting out the product, which is phosphorylated glucose. So you can think of it as a pipeline, a chemical pipeline that's taking in glucose and spitting out glucose phosphate. And of course, the rate varies with the concentrations of starting material. Another feature of the protein is that almost all proteins have more than one binding site, and they have regulatory sites to which other molecules can bind and either activate or inhibit the process of the enzyme. And the important feature is that these second regulatory sites have no necessary relationship to the structure of the substrate, in this case, glucose. So that means that during evolution, you can wire up any two processes in the cell. That's convenient and which provides you with an advantage. So it's possible to think of enzymes and other proteins in the cells as computational units. And this is drawing some proteins in the form of perceptrons, in which you have a number of inputs which are combined to produce an output. So hexokinase has glucose and ATP and spits out glucose 6-phosphate. Over there, aspartate transcarbamylase is one of the classic allosteric enzymes. That binds two small molecules and fuses them to form another molecule. And it also has a binding site for CTP. CTP is not a product of the enzyme. It's actually a product of a whole chain of enzymes. It's one of the precursors of DNA. And CTP acts as a feedback inhibition on this enzyme, thereby controlling the flux through the entire pathway. And this feedback inhibition is almost universal in cell metabolism. Two proteins of interest in the nervous system here. First of all, there's an NMDA receptor inserted in the membrane of central nervous system synapses, which binds to glutamate and opens channels to allow calcium into the cell. But it only does that when the receiving cell is the voltage changes. And so it's a coincidence between a voltage change and a sudden influx of glutamate that enables this receptor to open. And it's widely thought that the MNDA receptor underlies the ability of learning of many synapses to act as a Hebbian synapse. When the calcium enters the synapse, it produces a large number of changes, many of which are mediated by this kinase as a protein that binds to the calcium carried by calmodulin, and then phosphorylates a large number of other proteins. Phosphorylation, adding of a phosphate, is another way to switch a protein on or off. And included in the targets of this enzyme is CAM2 kinase itself. And if the calcium signal is large enough, CAM2 kinase becomes switched on and then is, from that point on, is indifferent to the level of calcium. So it's like a toggle switch, and it's widely believed that CAM2 kinase is a component of long-term potentiation and memory in the brain. CAM2 kinase acts as a spreads a signal over a large number of targets. It's also true that there, some proteins receive targets from a large number of other sources. So this is a protein involved in making glycogen. And I've drawn it as in a form of a chip here. That has a large number, that has a dozen or so sites on its surface which can receive phosphate groups. These are added by a number of different kinases, each of which is responding to a different feature of metabolism. It's the net number of these phosphate groups and, to some extent, the particular ones which are determine the activity of the enzyme. So this single protein is itself an integrating device which can collect information and produce an output. Now, clearly, even though individual proteins are very clever in what they can do, if you put different proteins together, then you can form small networks or complexes which are even more sophisticated. And indeed, it's well known that networks of proteins perform all of the sort of kind of elementary processing that one's familiar with in microcircuits. So they amplify, they provide coincidence detection, they can produce oscillations, and they store memory. All of these things have been demonstrated. They exist in cells, and they can be reconstructed from purified components. Just to give you a taste, here's an example from a blue-green algae, remarkable situation where three proteins generate a circadian rhythm, a 24-hour rhythm. So what happens is that chi C binds to chi A, and that stimulates chi C to add phosphate groups to three sites on this protein. And as they're added, there comes a point when chi B now finds a binding site. Chi B now binds and causes a change in chi C, which releases chi A. Now, at this point, the phosphate groups stop being added, and they start to fall off from the molecule. And as they fall off, there comes a point when chi B falls off, chi A comes back on, and the whole cycle repeats. And on the right there, you can see experimental data showing the rise and fall of total phosphate groups and, in particular, phosphate groups. Slightly more complicated network in E. coli. This is the one I work on in particular. So this is the network drawn as in a perceptron kind of way of the receptors that sense nutrients and other molecules in the surroundings of a bacterium and modulate the swimming. So these four kinds of receptors, between them pars the chemical universe of interest to the bacterium. And they all feed into this protein here, A, which is a kinase. And depending on the level of phosphorylation, that passes a phosphate group to a protein key Y, which diffuses to the motor and changes the swimming. Two other proteins here, R and B, work on a slower time scale, and they feed back on the receptors and methylate it, depending on whether they're occupied or not. And they constitute a short-term memory that's essential for the functioning of the bacteria and its ability to move up gradients. Now, that's bacteria. Now, obviously, in eukaryotes, you have very much more complicated systems, and this is just an attempt by Kitano's lab to portray the many interactions that are produced by the binding of one growth factor, EGF, to a tissue cell. And although I've just been concentrating on proteins, it's clear that proteins also interact with DNA in particular, and some of the most complicated computations that cells perform are those which are involved in the changes during development. The development of a higher animal, for example, involves the switching on and off of genes, and this is just a simplified picture of one small part of the sea urchin development. Each of the banded arrows, if you can see them there, is a gene, and all of the arrows coming into those genes are known regulatory influences which come from other genes in the system. So it's highly complicated, and indeed this regulatory level is much more plastic during evolution than other forms. Okay, so I hope this sort of very quick description is enough to convince you that living cells contain large numbers of what one can think of as computational elements, and certainly if one can transfer from chemical transformations to the analogous events in a microcircuit which involves the flow of electrons. And it's possible to model these, everything I've said up till now, it's possible to model either on a computer or even if you wish, in electronic hardware. But there are also things in cells which are not so easily modeled, and which, at least to date, don't feature in any hardware that I'm aware of. So to begin with, let's consider the input and output to the brain. The input, you have sensory structures, and the output, you have mainly muscle. So this is actually a micrograph of muscle. This is actually insect flight muscle, showing structures built of a large number of protein molecules. Actually, there's hundreds of them. But two main ones, the gold, is a filament made of one kind of protein called myosin, and the silver is a filament made of actin. And as I'm sure you know, these two interact with the cleavage of ATP. They're able to slide over each other in a process that's regulated by calcium and produces contraction. And it's an amazingly fast and efficient mechanism. Now, as far as I know, it might be possible to build a nano machine which performs perhaps not as efficiently, but you could try to mimic the action of a muscle, certainly using silicon or other materials. But what you most assuredly would not be able to do would be to make a structure that was as plastic and responsive as a real muscle. Now, if we think of a human muscle, in a newborn, that might be a centimeter long, and it might grow to, let's say, 10 centimeters in the adult. Throughout that entire period, that muscle is functioning in a way that's appropriate to the size of the body it finds itself in. It responds to exercise. It responds to disuse. If it's injured, it can repair itself. Now, what is it about this structure that enables this to occur? Well, one of the features is that it's not a static structure. Although it looks very regular, almost crystalline, the fact is that the molecules in any muscle are actually turning over. They're turning over with a half time of perhaps a number of days or even weeks, so that any changes, so that enables the thing to grow while still generating Fourth, but even more importantly, it enables the muscle to change its nature according to requirements. And it may be relevant that the structures that actually build the muscle, and the same is true for sensory structures, are actually the same components, proteins, that are involved in the processing. So it's not a separate system from the computational system. It's actually embedded in the whole system. Now, an even more important feature, perhaps, is that when the proteins are turning over in a muscle, they're not necessarily replaced in the same form. And that leads me to perhaps the most important feature of real cells, and that is that they're very variable. Now, I mentioned that there are something like 25,000 genes in a human encoding protein. But the actual number of distinguishable proteins that a human cell makes is vastly more than that. In fact, it's essentially uncountable. And one of the reasons I've already alluded to is that after proteins are made, they can be modified in a whole variety of ways. So I mentioned the protein that had received a number of phosphate groups. Here's another example. This is a little bit of that cluster of receptors in the bacterium. This is the outside of the bacterium, so it's seeing all of the chemicals the bacterium is swimming through. These are binding to the receptors. Here's the membrane, and depending on whether the particular receptor is binding to a serine or an aspartate, that receptor changes its conformation, and that conformation is transferred down to the kinase, as I mentioned. Now, these dots, which you see on the receptors, are actually sites to which methyl groups can be added. And there's actually eight of these for each of these receptors. And these are essentially the memory of the bacterium. So the more the bacterium has been exposed to some nutrient, the higher the number of methyl groups. And the higher the number of methyl groups, so that modifies the output from this system. So I'm sure people here can calculate it very easily, but if you have thousands of receptors, each receptor has eight potential sites of methylation, and there's actually four kinds of receptors. If you go through the combinatorics, you'll see that the number of states of this small cluster of receptors is astronomical. Now, clearly not all of them are important. Much of this is just purely chemical noise. But some of it most assuredly is important. And if any particular combination of methylation states occurred, was correlated with some important event in the life of the bacterium, we can be sure that it would make use of this. And in parentheses, I'd like to add that the size of the receptor cluster in a bacterium is not that different to a synaptic plaque in a central nervous system synapse. Okay, so you have post-translational modification changing proteins, but even more fundamentally, you have the fact that in eukaryotic cells, each protein is not made from a single gene, but from a number of segments of genes, which have to be put together to make an RNA before the protein is made. And in most cases, there are multiple segments which can be combined in different ways, and this leads to large numbers of different products. So here we have a potassium channel which can be made in all of the blue segments are always in the different proteins, and the yellow and the red ones are optional. This protein from Drosophila has a record 38,000 different forms which could be made. So I guess I'm running out of time, but let me just point out that in this highly variable nature of proteins is really manifest most clearly in the immune system, our human immune system, which can make something like 1,000 trillion, I think it is, different antibodies. And it's achieved by individual cells making different antibodies by this process of alternate RNA splicing. And then any that by chance recognize an antigen are then promoted, stimulated to divide, so you make large numbers of that particular antibody. And there's another refinement, which is a hypermutation in these genes, which again, which is by a sort of like an evolution, high affinity binding is selected. Okay, so just to my last slide, this is not a counsel of despair. I'm not saying that these processes cannot be modeled. I'm sure they will be. And it seems to me that it would be a good idea to try and build hardware that incorporates some of these features. And so for that, with that in mind, I put down just a few points that one might consider. First of all, you need a system of computational elements, linking them into circuits. That's pretty basic. Then another feature of real cells is that connections are not just local, but can be essentially between any two components in the cell through diffusion and molecular recognition. As I just mentioned, the individual components are not stereotyped. They're not all the same, but they're highly flexible and capable of a very wide range of properties, not only in their activity, but also in the connections. Input and output are achieved by highly plastic structures built from the same elements that are used for the computation. And then finally, the network must undergo continual stochastic change, and variants must be then selected according to the performance. Okay, I'll finish there. Thank you.